Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. New drugs and devices have revolutionized how we treat illness and disease over the past 50 years. Most were developed through clinical trials, people who volunteered to test medications or devices. Getting a drug, treatment, or procedure approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is an arduous process that often couldn't be completed without a clinical trial. But what are clinical trials and how do they work? To explain today, our guest, Dr. Neil Thomas, Associate Dean for Clinical Research and a pediatrician at Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. Dr. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Dr. Christopher Sciamana, who's an internal medicine physician at Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center and has worked on some clinical trials, including we may even try to recruit here some volunteers in the show. Dr. Sciamana, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Thomas, what exactly is a clinical trial?
Well, a clinical trial is really the end result of, in many times, years of research, sometimes even 20 years of research, taking the development of a discovery, which can occur in many different places, including our own labs, and test it in a population where it can impact health. It is a long process, and there are various phases of clinical trials, but the end result is to try to introduce new therapies.
I want to follow up and clarify on that a little bit because I saw a figure that said that it's often 15 to 17 years, like average, between the time a drug, device, procedure is, starts research to the time it actually gets approval from the FDA. Does that include the clinical trial, or do clinical trials themselves last that long?
No, that includes the clinical trial. The thing that is also important is that many times discoveries never make it to the phase of a clinical trial. So the large majority of targets will fail before they even reach the early stage of the phase one clinical trial. And then another percentage will drop off between the early stage clinical trials and achieving FDA approval.
I have to admit, I wrestled with this language as I was researching and doing my own research, and writing this introduction about whether. When we talk about clinical trials, about where we start with the referring to them as clinical trial, and how long do we go with as a clinical trial?
Yeah, usually talking about drug discovery, clinical trials will normally start with the phase one process, and a phase one in many times is healthy volunteers taking the medication and determining the toxicity or determining the effectiveness early stage. In certain medications or obviously devices, there's no healthy volunteers, and patients with the disease will be in the early stage to try to determine the toxicity and the efficacy. After phase one, they move to phase two, and that's a pilot stage where you really want to see how much of an effect there is, as well as determining any risks. So really weighing the risks and benefits. And then the phase three trial is the definitive trial. Many times the FDA requires a large or sometimes two phase three trials to get approval. And then phase four is generally a post-marketing. So after the drug is approved, patients still will be followed to determine in a larger scale any effects.
When we discuss the cost of pharmaceuticals, of medications, often those pharmaceutical companies and manufacturers come back and say, well, what really costs the most is R&D. Research and development. When us laymen hear those costs, we're like, how could it possibly cost that much? But when you look at it over years' time, decades' time sometimes, you can see how it would be expensive. But are those costs legitimate?
That's a loaded question,
I know,
I guess.
I know it is a loaded question. I know you work with pharmaceuticals.
Well, and I think pharmaceutical companies need to assure us as the public that these costs are legitimate. Many of the costs are actually early stage in drug discovery where many things fail. So they have teams of scientists who are developing therapies that will never reach the clinical phase. And so there's much of the cost is in the basic science and the discovery part of things. The pharmaceutical companies certainly need to recover the costs of all their failed attempts as well, and to cover their costs of the clinical trials. Whether that's a fair cost or not, I'm probably not the one to answer that.
And isn't it true that most do fail? I mean, a great majority do fail.
Absolutely. The large majority fail before they even get to the clinical trial, and then another high percentage fail during the clinical trial process.
Only about 10% actually, and it's different between drugs and the types of drugs, but only about 10% actually make it through the clinical trial stage.
Right. That's 10% that actually make it to the clinical trial stage progress. The large majority, probably 0.1%, actually make it to the clinical trial phase.
Dr. Sciamana, you have conducted clinical trials, and as I promised him in the introduction, we're going to talk about one that you're working on right now. But walk us through the process, if you would, of how a clinical trial works.
Well, first part, and Dr. Thomas mentioned this, I think you have to find treatment that might work. In the end, I always think this clinical trial is one of those terms that the public doesn't really understand, doesn't really
That's why
make
we're doing
sense
the show.
To them. And I really think it's kind of this basic thing. Does this work? And we get to test things in our life all the time to see if something might work. We try different things in the way we communicate with our kids and our spouse, and we're little experiment engines in trying things to see what improves our lives. So this is the same idea. Does this thing work? So you have to find a thing, a treatment, and I don't work with medicines. I work with behavioral treatments. So an exercise program, for example, that's kind of what we're studying right now. Does this exercise program make it an important difference in the person's life? Does it make an impact? Does it prevent some bad thing from happening? So in the case of our current study, does it prevent an injury from a fall? But the way it starts is you have to find the treatment. And define it really well. When it's a drug, it's actually pretty simple because it's a chemical molecule that actually drug trials in some ways are simpler than the ones we do because you can put a placebo or sugar pill
right.
and just, you know,
have the person
pick out and they won't know which one they're taking. But you have to define the treatment really, really well. So in the case of our work with exercise studies, you know, you have to have a really well-defined protocol. We do this exercise for this many minutes, and then we do this one and this one. You have to stick to that protocol. But once you define what the treatment is, then you have to identify what difference do we think would make? What's the most likely benefit we think we can make with this treatment? So in the early trials of statin drugs, it was really preventing heart attacks among people who had already have one. And they're a massive study, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people in those studies. So what difference do we think we can make? What can we prevent? Okay. By how much? Do we think we'll have a 20% reduction? A 30% reduction? And that's really important because you have to do what's called a power calculation because you have to figure out how many people to put in your study. And you have to make guesses. Well, I think the treatment will lead to 10% of people have a fracture from falling, but if they're not treated, it'll be 18. And you go back and you have to support all those based on other studies. You have to come up with a really good rationale. You plug those two numbers into a power calculator and it'll say, well, to see that difference, you need 2,438 people or something like that. You'll come up with a number. So then you decide how big the study is. And then you actually, to do it, you always have to figure out, well, how do I get this message to patients to be in this? How do I let them know about it?
How do you find volunteers?
Exactly right. And sometimes the studies are different. Dr. Thomas does a lot of work in the intensive care unit. So, you know, you're not mailing brochures to people's homes. They're in the ICU. In our case, it's often we mail brochures to people. Or some cases we'll get to work with a doctor who in the midst of a visit can say, you know, I think this is something worth trying for you. We don't have a good treatment for the problem you have, but there's a study we're doing to see if this new treatment might work. And then that would be a way that they would hear about it. So then there's the recruitment part. And after you find somebody who might be interested, they contact the study staff and they get screened to see if they'd be eligible. Because usually you have very narrow criteria. You're really only patients have to be certain age, certain disease, and so all that's very narrow, and you have to then go through the screening process, and then 80% of the people who call actually don't meet the criteria.
80%?
It's study by study. It's probably 80% when you take into account those who meet the criteria and are willing to be part of it. Hmm. Once they hear, you know, what's this study entail? You know, how much is it? You know, so example, in exercise, if you're going to put somebody on a treadmill and run them to the point of exhaustion, exactly right. You know, how about if we do that every week, Scott?
What slope are you going to have?
Exactly right, yeah. So it has to be a deal for the participant. It has to be worth their effort and not look too burdensome, not too much travel, not too many blood tests, no brain biopsies, or running on the treadmill to the point of throwing
There's
up.
A good side-by-side juxtaposition.
Right. So these are just examples, Scott. Yeah. You know?
Well, okay, Nick, you, as I said, you are working on one right now, and I think that it's a good time to talk about that because it is so timely. I saw an article last week about the number of ERs, emergency rooms across the country, that had seen a marked increase in the number of people falling, usually people who are older, but were experiencing injuries and enough that there were some who actually died from their injuries. That's actually what your clinical study right now, not the death part. Maybe you can explain what you're looking for.
So a few years ago, I had a problem that a lot of providers have, which is my patients are getting older and they're getting weaker, and they still haven't found that exercise is something that they want to do. And so we started a strength training program because that seemed to be what seniors were most excited about and wanted to be part of, and that's a need they could really relate to. You know, most people by the time they hit 75, they feel weak in a number of ways. They can't do a bunch of things they used to be able to do. So we started this, and we started it in a way that it was very social. So all the people who came ended up making new friends. And it turns out that, you know, although people don't stick with exercise, if you make a new friend, you tend to come back. And so, and they had a lot of fun because in the little breaks between exercises, they would laugh and tell stories and meet each other and just became part of a real fun group, and they wanted to stick with it. They use the F word, fun, pretty often in describing it. So we tried to look around and say, well, okay, what a bad outcome could we prevent with this? So that's in our previous conversation, right? So we looked around and saw the same problem was that as our population gets older, people are falling and getting injured. Death rates from falls have doubled in about a decade. There are fabulous medicines for preventing fractures from weak bones, but unfortunately, they have side effects that completely frighten people. So despite the cost of those going down 90%, the use has fallen in half. And these are bisphosphonates or Fosmax, Beneva, there are several of them.
What kind of side effects?
Well, there's two in particular that really frighten people. One is osteonecrosis, so a death of the jawbone, so requiring surgery.
Yeah.
And then there is an unusual fracture of the femur, the large bone in the leg.
That's a side effect.
True. Yes.
Wow.
You get nothing for free in life, you know. So,
but a femur and a jawbone. I mean, that's quite a trade.
And of course, there's been class action lawsuits. So if you watch daytime TV, you know, several years ago, you'll see commercial after commercial, and so that has really put the fear in people. And so there's a couple of really neat New York Times pieces just in the last year about people taking their chances with osteoporosis. And just recently, there's an article showing that those medicines help to reduce the number of hip fractures. Pretty light, and it kept going down year by year by year by year. But once people got really scared and the use of these has declined, that is no longer happening.
Let me turn to Dr. Thomas for just a moment. When this may be a good example of why people don't participate in clinical trials. I mean, number one, probably don't know about them. But number two, that fear factor, that the unknown, that you know, you've heard people, and I'm sure you, the two of you, have heard this. Oh, I don't want to be a guinea pig. that they feel like they're being experimented upon.
And it's a real concern, and I think that the burden is on us as investigators and our investigative team to make sure that we explain fully all the risks and benefits that go along with anything that we're asking someone to do. There's also a large body of federal regulatory oversight committees that make us govern our clinical research, our human subjects research, according to what most people would consider very ethical principles. So we have an institutional review board. We actually have three of them that review every research protocol that's done at Penn State Hershey. And their job is to weigh the risks and benefits and make sure that the potential benefits outweigh the potential risks. So even to have a study, Dr. Shimana study or a drug study or a device study, have any study even be approved to go through and have subjects eligible, needs to go through this review process. And every research institution, everybody that does research across the country, basically across the world, does the same thing.
I understand that phase one, you've been talking about four phases, that phase one, that safety is the patient safety, the volunteer safety, is that's the utmost. That's what you're looking at.
Absolutely. Phase one, and again, phase one can be different for patients, for diseases that are specific to patients. So again, cancer therapeutics are a great example. You would never give chemotherapy to a healthy person. So phase one studies in the cancer world are aimed at patients with the disease, generally patients who have failed usual therapy and don't have a lot of other options. So it gives them that potential benefit of a new therapy, but also the patient may be willing to take higher risks because they have no other options available. Much different than other drugs which would be used eventually over the counter, where there's healthy volunteers that get the drugs and then they are informed that we are looking for safety.
So. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. To learn more about clinical trials, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health, From Policy to Personal Choices. We're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. And yes, you did notice that Penn State Health is one of the supporters of the project, and we have two guests today from Penn State Health, Milton Hershey Center, Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, Dr. Neil Thomas, Associate Dean for Clinical Research and a Pediatrician at Penn State Health Hershey Medical Center, Dr. Christopher Schiamana. Excuse me, I'm having trouble. Maybe I should do a clinical trial on speaking on a Wednesday morning. Dr. Christopher Schiamana is internal medicine physician at Penn State Health's Hershey Medical Center. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Dave in Union Township. Dave, you're on the air. Hello, Dave.
Hey, I have two questions. The first question is, what percent of drug research is done by public institutions as opposed to private drug companies? And the second question is, several years ago, I read an extensive article in the New Yorker documenting abuses in the clinical trial process where drug companies would outsource the trial work to third parties who would then use illegal immigrants to do testing and would threaten the illegal immigrants with deportation if they were to disclose any negative results of the tests. And I'm wondering what kind of reforms have been done in the clinical trial process since that time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. Two questions here. Let's start with the first one, private versus public.
Yeah, there are different types of clinical research that can be done. There is federally funded clinical research, which is funded by NIH or Dr. Shimana's
National Institutes of Health.
Right, National Institutes of Health, or the Patient-Centered
Outcomes Research Institute,
which is another federal organization. And there are also industry-sponsored studies, and private institutions will do both. Most academic institutions do a combination of industry-sponsored plus federally sponsored studies. The oversight is the same from the human subjects protection standpoint. Every study gets reviewed by an IRB, either locally or centrally. And for drug studies, there is the oversight of the FDA that is independent, whether it's an academic institution sponsoring the study through the federal government or industry.
So when you're talking about oversight, just as he described in that article, I mean, that would seem very difficult to get approved by the FDA. Of course, as they're making the report, they're probably not going to say these were our subjects, or at least be specific about that.
Right, and I'm not familiar at all with the piece he's talking about. I'm certainly I left myself a note to try to find it. That would be incredibly unusual and obviously illegal if anybody was holding the outcomes of a research study and having a negative impact on the participants. This is a completely voluntary, not paternalistic, but open decision that patients make when they want to get involved in clinical trials. There are many horror stories in past history that go back to the Nuremberg trials from World War II that outline exactly what we can do and what we can't do. And I think ethically, I have no problem. I've been involved in clinical research myself. I've benefited from clinical research in my family. And anything that goes through an accredited IRB, I would have no issues with my family members participating in.
I'm curious about that. How have you, your family, how have you benefited from it?
So there's two stories. The first one is my youngest son was born at 27 weeks. So was born 13 weeks early. Mm. In my career, I was doing research on a medication called surfactant, a combination of federally funded studies plus industry funded studies looking at surfactant in the patient population I treat, which is older children. But he was born 27 weeks, his lungs were immature, and he received the same exact surfactant that I was studying in a different population in the delivery room. And now he's 16 years old, completely healthy, and ran track in middle school. Surfactant is one of the things that went through the 20-year clinical trial process and has really impacted care like you would not believe. Children who are born prematurely, it's now routine. The second is that now 4 years ago, I had a large heart attack. I was actually at the gym exercising and had a heart attack.
You got to watch those.
Can you edit that out?
Years before, I was a member of our own IRB, and I was studying what were called drug-eluting stents, which are basically stents that are placed in the coronary artery that stop blood vessels from closing up. And I have now two drug-eluting stents in my coronary arteries that were the exact same stents that I reviewed on the IRB years before.
You didn't have that heart attack on a treadmill, right?
No, I didn't.
See, now, Dr. Shimano, we don't have to edit that part out. But I do want to get back to something you had said earlier when you're talking about looking for volunteers for your clinical trial, that you're looking for those because they're one of the reasons you're doing this trial is because so many people have experienced falls. Talk about that, because we had a conversation. We were talking a little bit earlier about one of the reasons that we've seen such an increase. My initial thought was, well, it's because the population's getting older. That may contribute to it, but you had other reasons.
Well, so my staff, who's wonderful and is listening intently right now, would shoot me if I didn't give the website address. It's wisestudy.org. There's a nice little video. In a few minutes, you can figure out what it is we're trying to do. But in general, our population is getting quite a bit older. I mean, in 1900, I wouldn't be alive anymore. The expected lifespan at birth was like 50. I'm 51 right now. And so as we've gotten older, life has gotten a lot easier. Most of the things they were invented, get to plug into a wall or have a motor. And so now we walk less, we do physical labor so much less, even, you know, doing dishes and laundry was a very manual process standing, and now it's you push a button, you walk away. So our lives have gotten easier. As a result, we have less muscle, we have less bone, And as we get older, some that ends up leading to falls and fractures. So without a lot of great treatments, we decided to look at whether an exercise program could actually prevent fractures also, because the way the FDA works is, or the way insurers work in Medicare is that if you prove that you reduce a bad event from happening, you are judged very much like a medicine and have a chance to make that something that Medicare would cover. And right now, all the studies showing that certain exercises reduce falls. Well, a fall is not it's not an event that leads to a hospitalization or an injury. We are trying to prevent injuries, and the study is large enough to be able to show that. If our estimates are right, our goal is that if it's large enough to show a reduction in injuries, we can petition Medicare to pay for that. Just like happened with cardiac rehab. So when cardiac rehab studies showed that it reduced second heart attacks and trips to the emergency room, that became something that Medicare said needed to be paid for.
So what kind of people are you looking for? Age and
so in our case, actually, it's very simple. So we know that, you know, 80% of people often get screened out of a study. So ours is just you had to have had a fracture in the last decade from either a fall or some other, we call it low trauma. So a lot of people have vertebrae in their neck that are fractured simply because their bones are weak. That is a low impact fracture because that's just really from standing. So some kind of low impact fracture, either just from falling or in a vertebrae in the neck, age over 65, and the ability to walk 100 feet. Because, you know, we want people to participate in our program. If they can't participate, it doesn't really make much sense. And speaks English. Mm-hmm. So we have very few exclusions because we're really trying to make this something broadly applicable to folks. So that in the end, a doctor could say, without going through the list of 20 things that would make this person not eligible for the treatment, most people would be able to get it then. If that worked.
Something just reminded me of, though, when you said that you're looking for English speakers. Dr. Thomas, I understand that there are some populations that are not represented as well as others in clinical trials that, for example, historically, minorities have been not represented as well as they should.
Right, and that's absolutely true, and something that locally we are addressing as best we can with our diversity group. Who interacts with multiple populations across our entire catchment area, but also nationally. We are fortunate enough to have a clinical and translational science institute, which is sponsored by NIH. We are one of 64 across the country. And subject diversity and making sure that our discoveries are representative of the entire population is extremely important. And so there are national initiatives moving forward really aimed at increasing the diversity. We would like our study population to be an exact representation of the population of the U.S. as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Why no English or non-English speakers for that one?
It turns out that doing clinical trials in two languages is not simple to do. All your staff available all the time need to be bilingual. Every person that interacts with a research subject has to be bilingual, not to mention the materials are fairly easy to translate and back translate, but it's really the ability of a bilingual staff available at all times.
So a money issue?
Probably, yeah. I mean, the funder pushes you quite hard to do more with less. So how many people can you get in this study in a way that's cost neutral? And so there's a budget. We have to be respectful of that. If we did this study in San Diego, it might not be a problem at all. Mm. Here in Central PA, it's a fair bit different.
Dr. Thomas, and before we actually have someone who has gone through a clinical trial on the phone we're going to talk to in just a moment, but I did want to follow up on something you've talked about, and that is that 80% of those that volunteer do not actually make it. I also noticed as I'm reading the material that the word healthy is always in front of the word volunteer. So what does that mean? Clarify for us a little bit, and why the 80%? That's a surprising figure.
Well, I think the 80, it's certainly study specific. A study that would enroll anybody over 65 who did not have cancer would likely have a high screening rate. That 80% also includes patients who decide not to So they opt out once they understand the process. So it's very study specific. We know that only about 1% of the U.S. population participates in clinical research. So we're not reaching the target population that we need to. And that's why there's these local and national initiatives such as this to try to get the word out that it's a good thing.
Are the volunteers examined ahead of time before they go through the clinical trials?
Absolutely. Every as part of the screening or as part of the enrollment process, again, we need to make sure that the patients or the subjects, depending on the trial, are healthy enough to participate. Healthy volunteers are incredibly important in some of the studies that we do in our Heart and Vascular Institute. Deal with the autonomic nervous system, where we want to see how people respond to exercise or standing up or heat. And so those patients, those subjects are completely healthy. They can't have any disease because we're studying the human body's effects of motion. Again, if we're doing a cancer trial, then we're not going to have healthy volunteers, but we still want to have volunteers that are that meet the criteria as are defined by the protocol.
And I'm taking a stab in the dark here. This is a question out of left field. Is it more difficult to find healthy volunteers today because we have an opioid crisis? There's one. We have an obesity problem. I mean, I don't know whether that disqualifies someone or not, weight, whether that disqualifies someone or not. But is it more difficult to find healthy volunteers because they're not healthy, or is it just they don't know about it?
I guess the answer is it depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to do a survey, then healthy volunteers are relatively easy. We have a lot of researchers up at University Park that are part of our Penn State family who conduct research, and students are a big part of their research pool. We have a group of medical students, graduate students, and other volunteers across the community who participate in multiple early phase trials. Again, as a medical student myself, I spent weekends in a facility where I would get a medication and people would draw blood for the weekend, and that they paid me for my time.
You just maybe partially answered this. Are the people who volunteer, are they compensated?
They can be compensated for their time and effort, but it can't be something that is seen as something that would alter their ability to make the right decision about whether they want to participate. So it can't be coercive in any way. And that's something that the IRB also oversees.
And it's not something that someone is going to make a living at going doing clinical trial.
Absolutely not. I wasn't making rent money on it, but I could at least maybe get some food out of it.
We're going to speak with someone who's gone through a clinical trial in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing clinical trials today with Dr. Neil Thomas, an Associate Dean for Clinical Research and a pediatrician at Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, and Dr. Christopher Sciamana. He's an internal medicine physician at Penn State Health, Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Just to kind of clarify here, Hershey Medical Center, Penn State Health, you're a teaching hospital. You have more clinical studies. This kind of relates to the question we got from a caller earlier. Do you have more clinical studies as a teaching hospital affiliated with the university?
Absolutely. I think most academic institutions, their central hub is the place where most clinical research is done and not their outreach. We are trying hard to make sure that our practitioners in Lancaster and in Reading have access, their patients have access to clinical research as well. But that's a hard thing to accomplish because our central resources are central in Hershey. So there's no doubt that academic institutions have many more clinical trials and that sponsors and investigators go to the academic institutions because they know they can get the trials done.
Let's talk with Mary. Mary, I understand that you are someone who is involved. You were a healthy volunteer for Dr. Sciamana's study, correct?
That's right, yep.
So what have you done so far?
Well, I was first evaluated at Hershey Medical Center and then accepted into the study. And what happens is 3 days a week I go to an exercise class, and we do specific exercises. Some of them seem to be strength training, and others seem to be focused more on balance. And so that's what I do Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I go to these classes.
So as Dr. Sciamana listed earlier, the criteria, so you've had a fracture in the last decade or so?
Yes, I've had several falls and several surgeries because of those falls. So for me, I was really excited when I heard that somebody was trying to figure out something that could be done for somebody like me. It was very meaningful.
You know, we've talked about the benefits of clinical trials, the research aspect of it, and how you can make people healthier in the future. But what you're doing with the exercise, the strength training, the balance training, are you in better shape?
Yes, I think so. I think I am. And I know that some of the other people in my exercise group talk about, you know, they can tell differences, you know, in just their everyday functioning after having been in these exercise classes.
So do you feel more confident that you're safer at home?
Well, so far so good. You know, I haven't had falls. And I've only been in these classes since January. So I guess I'm waiting to see, but I hope that this is going to be helpful. I have every reason to think it will be, based on the reports of other people in my class.
So you feel optimistic, and you've had a good experience.
Oh, a very good experience. Mm. And one thing that might be relevant is that when I go to the class, my teacher, Sarah, is her name, she is, just like everybody I've met since I've been in the program, there's no pressure on anybody to do anything that they're not comfortable with. And we're all at different levels, and everybody in the class, we all just accept each other at all our different levels of expertise with different activities. So there's absolutely no pressure on anybody to try to be stronger than they really are, or anything like that. It's very accepting.
Mm. Mary, I'm glad to hear you're having a good experience. Good luck. Thank you very much for talking with us today. So I'm sure you're glad to hear that.
Absolutely. I mean, Mary, it's just a great experience, because I think what I remind people to do is to open their medicine cabinet and look at all the medicines that they have. Every single one that's a prescription drug is the result of 5,000 to 25,000 people who said, I'm willing to try this. And Mary's willing to try that. We don't get anywhere, we don't progress without people willing to be part of, we call it a clinical trial, but it's an effort to see if this works. And so I'm so thankful for Mary and all the people like that, because we can't progress without that.
Dr. Thomas, I'm curious, moving to the medication side, and tell me if this is how it works. I mean, you have people that have progressed maybe through stage one, and they move on to another stage of a clinical trial. And how it's done, I assume one of the main ways, maybe the only way, is to have a group of people that get the medication and a group that gets placebos. Is that accurate in describing how it's done with a medication?
For phase one trials, generally everyone gets the medication. It's open, what's called open label, so everyone knows. When you start getting into phase two and certainly into phase three, then we have a placebo group. And what's very important is that, especially for outcomes that can be interpreted differently, it needs to be a secret. It's called masked or blinded, so that no one knows if you're getting the medication or you're getting the placebo. That's incredibly important.
How is it decided who gets placebo and who gets the real thing?
It's complete random draw. It's not officially a flip of the coin, but that's what it ends up being in a fancy way.
Do you have people that have a positive outcome or respond positively even after taking the placebo?
Absolutely. There's a well-known placebo effect.
That's exactly what I was getting at.
and that's the reason, again, especially for subjective outcomes, when there's some determination that's not, if it's a blood test, it's pretty straightforward. I can't influence a blood test. If it's how do I feel or what's my pain level, that's a lot of subjective involvement in making that decision, and there's a huge placebo effect.
Okay, when you say huge, enough that you have to wonder about your results for the real thing.
Enough that the reason you have to randomize patients or to split them into two groups and keep them masked to the treatment is because you don't want that placebo effect to impact your end result, or your study may end up having no result.
Are there some that have that's happened?
There are studies that haven't been masked appropriately, that certainly the placebo effect has made a difference. It usually means when it comes to a drug that when the FDA reviews it for approval, if the protocol wasn't written correctly, the FDA won't accept that and another study needs to be done.
Looking at the statistics, the clinical trials that seem to be the most successful, not seem, are the most successful if you go by percentages. Hematology, blood diseases, blood-related disorders. The least successful, oncology, cancer, only about 5%. I mean, good for the people who, have an illness, a disease related to blood. But for cancer, that's kind of discouraging.
It's very discouraging. And one of the reasons that we've had a concerted effort on our campus and at University Park to develop a comprehensive cancer institute. We have people now who are making these discoveries in the lab, and we want to be able to take those discoveries all the way through the process of approval. The end result is to improve outcomes. Cancer is incredibly complex and much more complex now than it was 20 years ago.
Why is that?
Because we now know more about how patients get cancer, how the cancers respond to certain therapies. There's a whole host of molecular markers, both in the patient and in the type of cancer or the tumor that may respond to certain therapies. So now everything is targeted. So Chris mentioned in the past about the statin trials, how big they were. It was everyone who had a heart attack. The cancer trials are now getting smaller and smaller. So it's someone with a certain type of cancer who has these type of genetics and the tumor has a certain type of marker. And so there's going to be a lot of patients screened to get to that point. And the idea is really to get personalized with the therapy and really be able to attack that tumor.
And something very important, you use the word cancers. There are so many people who think of cancer as one thing when we're talking hundreds of different kinds of cancer.
Absolutely. And every cancer has different types of markers. It's interesting that certain types of cancers may have the same markers. And so NIH, through National Cancer Institute, is funding a study where there are therapies that are, that it doesn't matter where your cancer is, it matters what kind of markers you have. You can be enrolled in that trial.
Let's take a call from Maria in Lancaster. Maria, I also understand, is involved in the WISE study, but she did fall. Marie, I understand you have a question.
Yes, I do, for Dr. Sciamana. I won't say which group I'm in because we're not supposed to say that unless he wants to know. I was on vacation 2 weeks ago, and I did trip and fall. And as it is, my radial styloid, I have a radial styloid fracture, which is the bone that comes up to meet the thumb. And I just wondered if I'm supposed to call the study and let them know, or should I wait till I get a call every 4 months to relate what has happened on my calendar. And I was just wondering if I should make a personal call to the study instead of waiting for my next call from them.
Well, first off, I'm sorry to hear about what happened to you. It does I'll answer your question in a second, but it reminds me of the fact that when you do these studies, we don't expect zero people in the treatment arm to have a problem. I mean, the statin trials for heart attacks, 20% would have a heart attack in one group and 16 in the other. So it's not like we prevented all of them. So I'm really sorry to hear that. I do encourage you to reach out to our team. We can learn about it early rather than later. That would maybe give you peace of mind to at least make sure that it's recorded. The key is that it's recorded.
Yeah. Marie, thank you very much for calling in with your question. Let's go to Nicole in Hershey. Nicole, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having this topic. I'm an RS case manager for home health, and I was wondering more generally how to get patients to participate in clinical trials. But specifically, I have a feeling that a lot of my cases, as 99% are on Medicare, so they're over 65. Most have had falls with and without fractures, that they would be a good candidate for this particular clinical trial.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. And by the way, before you answer that question, Dr. Schiamano, I just want to make sure that, yeah, we have talked a lot about your study in particular, but there are a lot of clinical trials out there. And in fact, it's a good time maybe, and let's go back to her question, but Dr. Thomas, they're actually, if people are interested in maybe participating in a clinical trial, how can they do that?
Yeah, we've actually taken a concerted effort over the past few years to try to get the word out to potential participants, not only the patients that we see and that we treat, but the general public. And we've developed a website called Study Finder, and it's at studyfinder.psu.edu. And basically, it outlines all of the clinical research that we have going on throughout Penn State. So it includes all of our campuses across the Commonwealth. Most of the trials are trials that are done at Hershey, and you can search by a variety of different ways, by disease process, by age, or by location. It really is the one-stop shop, and we've seen that number grow monthly as we get the reports.
Dr. Schiamano, getting back to Nicole's specific question, it does sound like she could have some people who would be eligible for the study.
Yeah, absolutely. So once again, our URL is WISE Study.
WISE, W-I-S-E.
W-I-S-E, study.org. Phone number is 844-598-9598. But yes, home health people are often the ones actually identifying and working with people. I mean, being stuck at home means it's very hard to get the kind of exercise that you'd want. And so finding new treatments for people who fall, that's the thing that we're trying to solve. And they're absolutely high likelihood of being eligible. So,
Dr. Thomas, you know, other than Dr. Schiamano, a study going on right now, what illnesses, diseases, conditions are most essential right now, where you need the most volunteers, where you're having maybe the most difficulty finding volunteers?
Well, I think we've talked a lot about cancer, and obviously our Cancer Institute Clinical Trials Office is very active, not only in industry-sponsored trials for drugs, but investigator-initiated trials, again, taking our discoveries and moving them through the process. But also looking at other therapies not involving drugs around cancer. So Chris has a outstanding exercise program that includes the WISE study plus others. We have investigators in our Cancer Institute who are studying the effects of exercise after chemotherapy, after treatment of disease, to try to make the recovery as healthy as possible. So cancer is always high on our list. Our heart and vascular group also has a number of devices, both on drugs as well as devices. So different devices that get put in, including the stent that I mentioned before. Those types of trials are always ongoing.
Now, those volunteers would have to, for example, have had a heart attack or heart disease?
Right. So depending on the trial, they would have to meet the entry criteria, which are defined by the disease of study.
Mm-hmm. And cancer, you said something earlier that struck me. You said that when people have run out of options, does that mean that they've been told that they're terminal, or that you know, there are no other treatment options, they're willing to try this?
Yeah. Generally with cancer, there are standard treatments that you try that have been proven to be effective. They aren't good for everyone. And so many times then you move to treatments that are being tested to see if they're effective. If you don't qualify for those, then the advantage of an academic medical center being right here in central Pennsylvania is that you have access to these phase one, these early phase trials.
I want to thank both of you for being with us, Dr. Neil Thomas, Dr. Christopher Schiamano with Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. In about 30 seconds, Dr. Thomas, what message would you like to leave about clinical trials with our listeners?
Well, I think Dr. Schiamano summed it up very well and basically said that we need to figure out what works and how we can make that discovery and then also disseminate that information to the patients that we treat. And the only way to do that is to do this type of clinical research.
Thank you very much for being with us today. And hopefully we'll get some healthy volunteers out there who will participate and will make some advances. Thank you very much for being with us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have a Smart Talk road trip. We are going to be at Nisley Vineyards in Bainbridge, Lancaster County. So if you would like to come see our broadcast, you can do that. Go to WITF.org/events to RSVP. But that's tomorrow morning, talking about Pennsylvania's wine industry, history, the economy, and tourism having to do with wine. So stop out tomorrow.